Hi, this is Newt. Due to the virus, I'm recording from home, so you may notice a difference in audio quality. On this episode of Newt's World, I have been friends with my guest today for 30 years. In a sense, we both grew up together. I was elected Speaker of the House in November 1994, just as his new radio career was starting to take off. We were drawn together. We knew we shared the same values, values of freedom, integrity, love for the Constitution, love for this great country of ours. It is no surprise to me that he's become one of the most influential voices in conservative talk radio and one of the most watched shows on Fox News. He's joining me to talk about his new book, Live Free or Die, America and the World on the Brink. I think it's a profoundly important book for everyone to read at this moment. And as he says, quote, "I wrote this book to sound an alarm, as a warning to my fellow patriots about the left's undying commitment to turn America into a land our parents, founders, and framers would not recognize." I'm pleased to welcome my guest and my good friend, Sean Hannity.
The question we're asking talk radio, its effect on the political process, why you listened, when you started listening, what do you think of this medium? Do you think it has any effect on the political process? And so on and so forth. News Radio WGST, AM and FM.
A vote for Biden is a vote for Bernie and every extreme radical socialist and agenda item ever proposed.
Liberalism on a massive scale failed the working men and women in this country. I'll tell you, everybody in our industry today, unfortunately, I've said journalism is dead. We have an information crisis in the country.
I'm hoping that I'm right. We're less than 100 days away from the most important election in our lifetimes.
This will be one of the most fun podcasts I've ever done, because the person who's my guest is somebody I feel so close to. I think of him as a younger but dramatically more successful brother. We go back early. Now, come on, Sean.
I'm laughing.
It's my podcast. I get to do the introduction. You get to do the introduction on your radio show. So
yes, sir.
He has got a very important new book out, which I'm very excited by. Goes on sale August 4th, Live Free or Die, America and the World on the Brink. And I know that for years, he did not want to write another book. It's a lot of work. Given 3 hours a day on radio, plus a TV show every night, you know, the guy's pretty busy. So I know this was important to him, or wouldn't have done it. However, before we get into Live Free or Die, America and the World on the Brink, which I really recommend to you to read, because I can tell you, it hits every single major thing I believe in. I want to ask Sean Hannity, would you carry us back to the primeval time when we first got to know each other?
Okay, first of all, that was a great introduction. I want people to know what you mean to me, because I started my radio journey in my 20s, and I don't know what happened. I got behind a radio microphone, the light went on, and it changed my life. And I was terrible at it in the beginning. I got fired, thrown out of town, rightly so. I was so bad. And then I got my first professional job in Huntsville, Alabama, and this was 1990 and to 1992. And then you came to Decatur, Alabama. I knew you were coming to town. I knew who you were. You were in the beginning of renewing American civilization, which, by the way, are must-view tapes, audio tapes, relevant today as they were then. And it became the foundation of the contract with America, and you leading the way to take back the Congress for the first time in 40 years. Anyway, I'm this young kid in this suit that didn't fit, with a tie that looked horrible and a unibrow. And we met in a Holiday Inn, and we didn't have the technology we have for radio today. We had this old Marty system, and that is like sending a signal to a signal to another signal and back to the studio. We managed to get it on the air. And there's a picture somewhere. I knew I saw it a number of years ago, and I saved it. And I wanted to show it to you, and I got to find it and put it online. You have changed my life. You've impacted my thinking. You've made me a better person. You've made me more knowledgeable. And it all started in that Holiday Inn in Decatur, Alabama, somewhere between 90 and 92, when you gave a speech, "We're willing to help this young kid out." You're probably sitting there, "Oh boy." And then it turns out that in 1992, a mutual friend of ours, Neil Bortz, moved from one talk radio station to another in Atlanta. And I was called, I auditioned for 2 days, and I got hired, and I moved to Atlanta, which was your home city. And I moved there in 1992, and the intersection of our lives was such that this was you formulating the Republican takeover of Congress for the first time, if people can imagine this, in 40 years. It started with a series of educational tapes known as Renewing American Civilization, and you mobilized a national effort. It's over 25 years ago. It's crazy. Waves of conservatism in my political lifetime. One would be Reagan. Two would be the contract, the Newt Gingrich revolution. And three would be what's going on right now with Donald Trump. And a lot of our fellow Republican conservatives didn't think Trump would govern as a conservative. You and I knew better. We were right. And we put everything we had on the line telling our friends he will do what he's saying. And thank God he did. But anyway, it culminated with a couple of things. And I want people to understand this. So the night that you became Speaker of the House, I remember seeing you that day, that night. I remember walking with a huge entourage. They didn't have cable news as we know it today. And you had a room behind where I was emceeing the event for you that night when you became Speaker. It was a great night. Lost my voice. And I didn't know I was living through history at that time. There is video of it. And I remember I learned so much watching you. And you told me confidently that day, this is how many seats we're going to win. I don't remember the exact number. And that's how many we won. And you had it down to a science. And it was all ideas-based, solutions-based, conservative-based. And while I was a natural conservative inclined towards everything Reagan, even when I was in high school and college, I got to tell you, you transformed my life. And then I get to be the MC the night you become Speaker, first time in 40 years. Then you become Speaker, and then I get an opportunity to guest host a show on CNBC for Roger Ailes. He was running CNBC at the time, called Talk Live on a Saturday night. You weren't doing interviews at the time. You gave me a full hour, and I had done one show for Roger, and I said, I think if I ask Newt Gingrich, he might do me a favor and do the show. And he goes, you can get Newt Gingrich? He says, if you can get him, you got the hour. And you did the whole hour with me, and I think we took calls. And since then, our paths have crossed so many times. We've lived our lives together, parallel lives. You have pushed me intellectually to areas that I never went to. I knew instinctively conservatism was right, but reading your books, interviewing you over the years, your deep, what most people don't really know is you're really a professor and historian at heart, more than I think anything political. And your knowledge of history to me is second to none. And you force me to go deeper every time I'm around you, with you, and all throughout these many years. And you talk about whatever success I might have or not have in life. And I'd never expected the ride that I've gotten on, but you are so instrumental in helping me formulate who I am today. And I frankly look at you as family. And I love you for who you are as a person, as a patriot, as a transformational historical figure in your own right. And this is very meaningful to me to do this interview with you, because I don't get to tell you this very often. We've had dinners together where I get to tell you anecdotally how all these things happen, but I wanted to take the moment and just say thank you for all you've done for me. You've been an amazing, inspirational figure and made me better at everything that I do every day.
People are never going to believe that I didn't pay you an enormous amount.
No, it's all true.
One of the nicest compliments I've ever had. And of course, the feeling is mutual. The times we've done stuff together, whether it's going to Yankee Stadium or...
Oh, yeah.
The thrill that night of being, first of all, being able to ask you if you'd be willing to MC that evening, which I knew was going to be amazing, but turned out when we actually lived it out to be beyond imagining. I remember you MC'd one time and my younger daughter, Jackie Cushman, got into a roast of me. And you were the MC. And another time we had Lou Holtz and Joe Paterno.
Don't remind me about that. That was the worst night of my life. Don't ever follow Lou Holtz at a roast. Yeah. That was the worst moment. I literally gave up after 3 minutes because he tore the room up.
Yep.
And everything that I had planned to say, he had already said 1,000 times better. And I knew I was beat. And I'm like, okay, I was sweating profusely because I knew I could not match what he just did. And I did 3 minutes and said, goodbye, thanks. One of the worst speeches in my life that night. Oh, man.
One of the things I most fondly remember is I had done a novel about Pearl Harbor, and you were doing it with Ollie North in Honolulu. And I remember
the only time I went. Yeah.
You know, I remember us, though, which somehow your team had gotten permission for us to broadcast from the Missouri. And we were broadcasting with the sunken Arizona behind us in the shot. And at one point, Ollie North said, you know, the Missouri was our answer to the Japanese sinking the Arizona. And I just thought it was a really chilling historic moment. And I'll always look back fondly on that particular experience, which your team made possible, and which I think was a great show. It was a chilling thing to do that.
It was chilling, especially it hit home for me. And I, as you get older, a little wiser, I now have a 21 and 18-year-old. I appreciate my father and mother more than ever because they grew up so poor. And my dad fought 4 years in the Pacific, grew up very poor in Bed-Stuy. It was a big deal that he got out of Bed-Stuy and I got a 50 by 100 lot in Franklin Square, Long Island. My mom was a prison guard. Yeah, that was special for me. I stand on the shoulders of my parents. My four grandparents came from Ireland. We all do. We all have a story to tell. And I'll tell you one other moment that really made a difference in my life. Going back to the night you were speaker, I don't know if you remember this. So you're in a room with ABC, NBC, CBS, and I assume the New York Times and everybody else. And in comes this young talk show host. I just said, hey, Mr. Speaker. And the whole room, it was like E.F. Hutton. They get quiet. They're like, who is this little kid that just walked into the room? I said, would you mind doing my radio show tomorrow? And being who you are, he said, absolutely. I'd love to. And you called in the next day. Well, I barely had a voice that day. And that's who you were to me. You didn't say no when you were now the Speaker-elect of the House of Representatives, third in line for the presidency.
I don't know if you know this, by the way. I did my first talk radio show in the summer of 1960.
Wow.
I've been on and off doing this a long time. And part of what I admired about you coming along was that Rush had really created modern conservative talk radio. Other people have done talk radio, but not with the scale of impact. Rush had been a big part of our ability to emerge in the late 80s and early 90s. I could see in you the kind of growth potential to be in that league. And it's actually true. You may think I'm just pandering to you, but I've been interviewed a fair amount of my career. You had a seriousness about trying to learn and a seriousness about actually following the conversation. You just didn't show up with three questions or whatever, but you really wanted to engage. Most people make a living off of the five things they learned that they just keep maniacally repeating. But you actually evolved. I mean, you're still evolving. You're extraordinarily successful. Your total audience between radio and TV is astounding. You are a very close friend of the President of the United States. And yet, I can tell you, in any 2 or 3 week period, I see a few things change, a few things you're thinking about differently. And I watch you, the sort of the self-taught university of Sean Hannity. In the course of a year, you interview so many people. You have so much talent that comes through your two shows. They're just listening to the right people, asking the right questions. You get literally a graduate education just being Sean Hannity.
Well, you're very kind. I'll take the compliment that I don't think I deserve, but I'll only say this. I'm always looking to get better. First, let me backtrack and say, thank God for Rush Limbaugh. And Rush, he stood in front of a forest, if you will. When he started nationally, there were like 200 talk radio stations in the country. It's now the number one format in radio. There are thousands AM and FM talk radio stations all across the country. Save the AM band. And frankly, in many cities now saving the FM band. Our mutual friend Neil Bortz called him the Babe Ruth of talk radio. Nobody matches the Babe, but he forged that path. He paid a heavy price for it. He knocked down every tree, and then all of us that came after him benefited from the path that he forged. And it wasn't easy. And he became a national target almost immediately. Nobody had heard this before. I mean, that's 1988 when he syndicated. I started in radio in, I think, 87, the first time I did a radio show. And the beauty of Rush is he forged that path for all of us. But if you're asking me if I would ever be on 630 stations and in my 25th year at Fox in Decatur, Alabama, and that Holiday Inn that day, I would have looked at you and said, okay, what are you smoking? But I've been blessed beyond what I think I ever deserved. I believe that. I always think I'm going to get fired. I think I've done my last show every day. If you ever told me I would do a 22-minute opening monologue nights on TV and it would actually do well, I wouldn't have believed it. But it happened organically. And I do see growth every day. You've always talked your whole life about lifelong learning. I can go through the different phases of Newt Gingrich historically, Toffler and Demings and all these great people that you would make people aware of. You are brimming with ideas. You're on a whole other level. I acknowledge I'm not there. And if I have any ability, I think it's to recognize very smart people like yourself and pay very close attention to what you're saying and who you're reading and what you're writing. And I read all your books, and I think I'm a better person because of it. I love this country so much, and you know, to go back to the book part of it, I didn't write a book for 10 years because I hate writing. It is painful to me. It is too much work. Where on radio and TV, I say it, it's done. As imperfect as it is finished. When you write a book, obviously, you got to come up with your chapters. You got to come up with the concept, where you want to go, where you want to take it, and it's ever evolving. And a first draft is just that, a first draft. Then you got to sand it, prime it, polish it, paint it, sand it again, and it's just a much more arduous process for me. I find it difficult, although I'm writing a monologue every night on TV. Half of it is written and the other half is extemporaneous and ad-libbed. All of radio is ad-libbed for me. This interview is ad-libbed. And I prefer that format better. But the moment to me is this is all hands on deck. This is it. Reagan said that freedom is but one generation away from extinction. Well, what Joe Biden's stated agenda is, if it's even going to be Joe Biden, does he have the mental alertness to make all these decisions? In many ways, I find he's influenced by way too many people, and he's a shadow and a ghost of a candidate hiding in his basement. But he's embraced in the last 2 weeks, literally plagiarizing Bolshevik Bernie's economic plan. He's pledged trillions of dollars to AOC's Green New Deal. He's adopted Beto O'Rourke's gun policy of confiscation, actually said it. And then you've got Pelosi, Schumer, and Biden, 125 years of combined Washington swamp failure. And if their stated plans are implemented, this Green New Deal, eliminate oil and gas, Biden's on board with it, the lifeblood of the world's economy, everything is going to be free. I do have a historic chapter in the book about, well, one, what makes America great. As Franklin said, a republic, if you can keep it. But I have a whole chapter on socialism, a history of failure. Everything that they're saying has been tried before. Every promise they're making is unsustainable. My argument is simple. If you think that you're going to have this cradle to grave utopia that Bolshevik Bernie, AOC, and Biden are promising you, let me ask you, have these cities that have been run for decades by liberal Democrats like New York City and Chicago and Seattle and Portland and Los Angeles, again, they all have one thing in common, liberal Democrats, their policies for decades, have they been successful in securing safety and security and law and order for the people in their cities? The answer is obviously no. If we believe that rights are God-given, that were endowed by a creator, certain inalienable rights. I actually remember it. Joe thinks, you know, endowed by, you know, the thing.
We hold these truths to be self-evident. All men and women created by, go, you know the thing.
Yeah, God, the creator of everything. But life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Mr. Speaker, you tell me, how do you pursue happiness if you can't go to your grandmother's house in Chicago on the 4th of July and not get shot? How can you pursue happiness? A 7-year-old little girl lost her life. How can you pursue happiness if your mom makes a wrong turn and you're an 8-year-old little girl in Atlanta and goes into the autonomous zone there where the Wendy's and the Rayshard Brooks incident took place? And they had guys a week and a half earlier, I was showing them with long rifles and AR-15s, and they took over, what, 2 city blocks. How do you pursue happiness if you're in an autonomous zone, Chop Chaz, Summer of Love zone? And I interviewed almost for a full hour Horace Lorenzo Anderson Sr. His 19-year-old son was killed in that Summer of Love zone. How do you pursue happiness when every one of these cities have another thing in common? Their government education has failed spectacularly. If you want to deny kids a ladder to success, just rob them of education, because it's the foundation of all success. But if you don't water and offer sunlight and nurture every child with safety, security, and education, they're shut out. For those that would put their hope in this socialist utopia, which is everything is free, free education, government job, government wage, government vacation, government healthy food, government health care, government retirement. Okay, well, how did that Obamacare thing work out? Because the promises were clear. Keep your doctor, keep your plan, and every family's going to save on average $2,500 a year. Well, millions lost their doctors, millions lost their plans. On average, in America, we're now paying 200% more for health care. And there's almost 40% of the United States that has only one Obama-Biden care exchange option. How did that government program work out for you? Where's Social Security headed in the future? So it's bankruptcy. Where's Medicare headed? Bankruptcy. What has government done well? And for me, if you heed the admonition of Thomas Paine, the great pamphleteer in 1776, Common Sense, what did he say? He said, were the guides and dictates of human conscience irresistibly obeyed, we'd have no need for any other lawgiver. That not being the case, governments are formed to protect people. And governments in its best state are but a necessary evil, in its worst state, an intolerable one. You are the great historian. Mao and his revolution, the Bolshevik revolution. How's socialism working out in Cuba and Venezuela? Or what happened to Finland's government that was dismantled and the promises of socialism there that is often cited? It sounds good, I guess, psychologically. It's reassuring to people to say, you'll never have to worry about a single thing in your life because your government's going to take care of you. These are false promises. You don't need an MIT diploma to figure out that mathematically $92.4 trillion in 10 years for the Green New Deal, $52 trillion Medicare for all, or Obamacare on steroids, we only take in $4 and $4.5 trillion a year, that there's no way these promises can be fulfilled. They know it. It's about power. It's not really about people, because it seems like, and I'll give you another example, in all those liberal cities where the violence is so bad and the educational system is so bad, that these mayors and governors seem more concerned about taking shots at Donald Trump than they seem to be about protecting the innocent men, women, and children that are being shot and dying in their cities. And I'll take it a step further. You want to know how bad education has gotten in some cities run by liberal Democrats for decades? Per capita, the city of Baltimore, the third highest spending city in the country per student on education. What percentage does your audience think of 13 separate high schools? What percentage of high school students in those public high schools are proficient in math? The answer, I hate to tell you, is not a single child, not one, and very few in reading. A friend of mine, Barry Farber, often said, and there's never been a country in the history of mankind that has accumulated more power and abused it less than the United States of America. And then I add to that, but also use that power to advance the human condition. And the only reason that America gets to share innovation, creation, is capitalism, free market, risk, reward, entrepreneurialism. That's because we live free. I know it might be appealing to people to hear that they're going to take care of your every need, but the problem is we're taking away the natural stress of life, not uncontrollable stress. that makes every human being dig down deep into their heart and soul out of necessity and says, well, what do I want to do with my life? Why am I here on this earth? What talent did God give me? But you can't have any of that without the fundamentals of law and order, safety, security, and education. I know that's a long intro to my book, but that's basically it. And I learned a lot of this from you.
One of the things I want to focus in on, because I watch you every day on your show, dealing with these kind of issues head on, bringing in guests to really cut through the baloney. And one of the things you talk about is something which I'm fascinated with because I think it's so totally crazy, and that's slavery reparations. And you have a very strong section on that in your book. Do you want to just comment a second about how your own thinking has evolved and how you come down on this?
To me, what matters more than anything is success. We've got to ask ourselves, if we agree on this premise that we're all created by God and rights come from God and talent come from God, and I just believe that people have that talent and have that ability. You know, I know there's this whole movement to trash our founders and our framers. Yes, we're an imperfect people, as all people on earth are. But the beauty of our system is that we have a constitutional republic where we can right wrongs and correct injustices. It's amazing how many of our framers and founders wanted to rid us of slavery at the time. They put in place in the imperfect system with the ability to right wrongs, correct injustices. You're the greatest historian I know on the Civil War. I don't know anybody that knows more about the Civil War than you do. Now, the Civil War is fought over a lot of reasons. One of the big ones was slavery. And I believe reparations divide the country. I think people would be shocked. I actually put this in the beginning of that section of the book. It was only a few years ago that Hillary and Barack Obama, they were against slavery reparations. That might shock people. And I think for the right reasons, but now it shows how far left the Democratic Party has gone. And I'll say this, we can compare records now. Joe Biden was 51 years in the swamp. Biden, Pelosi, Schumer, 125 years swamp failure. What's Obama Biden's record? After 8 years, this is it. I said it every night and every day on purpose. I wanted to tattoo this into every voter's brain that would hear my voice. 13 million more Americans on food stamps, 8 million more in poverty, the lowest labor participation rate since the 70s, the lowest home ownership rate in 51 years, the worst recovery since the 40s, and they accumulated more debt than all 43 presidents before them combined, and they didn't have the worst pandemic since 1918. That is their record. Donald Trump's record, pre-coronavirus, he shattered every unemployment record for minorities in the history of the country, record low after record low unemployment for African Americans, Hispanic Americans, Asian Americans, women in the workplace, youth unemployment, African American youth unemployment. How did he do it? Well, he did the things that you and I believed in our whole life. He cut taxes. Finally, somebody cut the red tape, got rid of all the burdensome regulation, and that created a thriving business atmosphere. It was very much what similar to Reagan, but I'd argue even on steroids in terms of ending bureaucratic regulation, and then also controlling the borders. That was important. And I think that he's been a transformational historical figure, and he did it boldly, and he did it when even people in his own party doubted it could be done. To me, that's the type of leadership the country and the world needs. And so the answer to me is, a rising tide lifts all boats. Jack Kemp repeated it. Former President Kennedy talked about it. And that is an economic environment that creates opportunities. Those manufacturing jobs that Biden and Obama said ain't coming back, they came back. And now they're going to come back manyfold based on what China did to the entire world with coronavirus. They lied to the world, and look at the disaster. I hope that answers your question on reparations. The answer is believing in every individual, giving them safety, security that they deserve. And once we fulfill that obligation, then every American has the responsibility to find their love and their talent and their passion in life. everyone that I know that does certain jobs, they have a calling. I have no idea why this crazy red light went on in my studio one day, and I had this passion to do radio, and I listened to it as a kid, and it just changed my life. I had no idea where it was taking me, but I worked for free, and my first paid job in Huntsville was $19,000 a year. I took a pay cut. I had a business at the time. With those fundamentals of safety, security, and education right, which we can do, we're the United States, then there's no limit to American untapped greatness that we have in this country. That is every man, woman, and child. The people make America great. You know, that's why the victory of Donald Trump shocked the world, because the elitists and the swamp, they didn't think he had a chance in hell of winning. You and I believed he could win, and we stated so. There were not many of us out there that are conservative telling our fellow conservatives he will govern conservatively. I said it because I knew it was true, because I knew him for 25 years. Not having that political background, to me, was a huge asset. It ended up being a liability, because I don't think he understood just how dark Washington can be. And we remained friends after you were Speaker. You wrote your book about lessons learned the hard way, and they put you through hell unfairly most of the time. But you fought, and you changed the country, and you're a transformative historical figure.
By the way, yeah. I just want to affirm, because I was there, I think without you, it's very likely that Trump would not have won. Both your voice and your advice. Because of your personal friendship, you had a greater capacity to tell him what he needed to hear than almost anybody I knew. And you still do to this day. And so I think in that sense, just as in my own case, and in Reagan's case, transformative figures only succeed if they're surrounded by people who help them and are honest with them. No one person can achieve the scale we're talking about. In the case of Trump, you were central to the ability to pull this off.
I neither confirm nor deny I ever talked to anybody. There's my answer on the short side of that. But I will tell you this. The forces of D.C., which you lived through, I remember once in the middle of your being Speaker, I remember asking you, how do you put up with this? Before you became Speaker officially, you won the election. The Gingrich that stole Christmas and Time and Newsweek that actually were real magazines back in the day, and all of these attacks. And I remember, I don't know, maybe a couple of years into you being Speaker, you saying to me something that stuck with me. And I remember the sacrifice, the personal sacrifice that nobody's going to ever pay attention to. And you said, I have in the central part of my brain a part of me that is always exhausted. I never thought I would understand that. I understand it now. But you did it because this was your passion and your belief, and you were right. Reagan was right. The third wave is right. But the forces, as bad as they were against you and as bad as they were against Reagan, I've never seen anything like what they're doing to this man. It's every second, every minute, every hour of every day. You once said on my radio show and TV show, you reiterated it, that they wake up in the morning. How can I hate Trump today? It's true. Look at what they put the country through with conspiracy theories, lies, smears, slander, besmirchment, character assassination, libel, you know, about a hoax with Russia and collusion that never existed.
And my good friend who teaches Civil War history at Princeton wrote me one time, and he said that he did not believe anybody had been attacked like Trump. Alan Guelzo is a great historian. He writes me in December of 2016, and he said, not since the South Carolina slave newspapers vilified Abraham Lincoln has anybody had the kind of personal assault that Trump is living through. And it's absolutely true. You picked one of my favorite Revolutionary War era phrases to be the beginning of your book title, Live Free or Die, which is from New Hampshire. I'm just curious, why did you pick it? What were you trying to say to the American people by going back and pulling up a Revolutionary War. I think it was a tribute at an event after the war on behalf of the senior general produced by New Hampshire.
Because that's the moment. Actually, the working title was always Live Free or America Dies. And I ended up putting in Latin at the very bottom of the book, Live Free or America Dies. The official title is Live Free or Die America and the World on the Brink. But in Latin, it says Live Free or America Dies. You mentioned the mob in the media. They are a mob. They are state-run television. They are every second minute hour of every day. They hate this president. Like you said, they wake up hating this president. How can I hate him today? How can I destroy him today? Never giving him credit. I often say if he cured cancer, Donald Trump, they'd want to impeach him for curing cancer. That's how bad it has gotten. And you live through hell, and I think it's hell on steroids and human growth hormone for him. And he has the biggest campaign contribution ever in the history of any presidential election. He's got the 99% of the media mob echoing all things democratic socialist, radical socialist. And we saw this in the hearings with Bill Barr. They wouldn't let the man get a word in edgewise. It was a all-day, nonstop campaign commercial for Joe Biden. That's a force against Donald Trump. Now, I don't know what's going to happen. We're in the 100-day countdown now. But I'll say this. It would be the greatest vindication of any candidate in history if that mob in the media has to choke on the words, we can now project that Donald J. Trump has been reelected the 45th president of the United States. Now, do I believe that can happen? Absolutely. And watching the president closely the last couple of weeks, he is dialed in. I know him. I've known him for 25 some odd years. I know when he's dialed in and it's game time. And Donald Trump, when he says he's not sick of winning, he's not sick of winning. Donald Trump is in this to win it. Maybe some people don't like his style. I think he said it really well in a town hall with Brett and Martha when he said that I wouldn't be here if I don't fight. People got to remember that the reason we got new trade deals with China and our Western European allies and Mexico and Canada, the reason that he got the money to build the wall and he'll have, what, I think 450 miles of new wall by the end of this year is because he never gave up. Congress put every obstacle. They were never going to help him, even though they believed in it. Democrats did. Just like Obama and Hillary were against reparations, they were all for the wall in Obama's second term. Now Trump wants it. They're against it. This is a very winnable election, but you know elections better than anybody. To win an election as a conservative or Republican in this case, you have to run the table. Florida is a purple state. You got to get Florida. Have to. Must win. Georgia, must win. North Carolina must win. Iowa must win. You can't win. No Republicans won the presidency without the Buckeye State, without Ohio. Then you got to pick off of Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, maybe Minnesota's in play. You got to hold Arizona and you got to make a play for Nevada and New Mexico. You got to look to win New Hampshire and you got to look at Maine's second congressional district. It matters. So every vote is going to matter. I think if you're asking about where Live Free and Die come from, do I really believe this is it? Yeah, I do. I think if we go down the path, the stated policies of this party at this time, the leader is now adopted, I believe that it's irreparable harm and the America we grew up in, our parents grew up in, that we want our kids to grow up in, will become unrecognizable. Socialism always ends in failure. You know that better than anybody.
First of all, I agree with you. I think this is a very winnable election. My personal hunch is that Trump will win it and will win it decisively enough that, in fact, we will pick up the House and Kevin McCarthy will be Speaker and we'll actually pick up a net of two in the Senate. But having said all that, I want to close this on a somewhat different note, which is it hit me while you were talking a little while ago. This is so different than what every left winger thinks of you. The very idea that you would have your title in Latin at the bottom of the page, I think is just fascinating. Why would you do that?
you know, I love every article ever written about Sean Hannity starts with he's a college dropout. I had 12 years of Catholic education. My 4 years of high school were in a seminary, only 100 students starting out in the class. And we studied theology. We went to Mass daily and we studied Latin. I was never good at it because I didn't want to work hard at it. I paid every penny of college myself because I knew my parents didn't have the money. And I had worked since I was 8 years old as a paper boy. I was a dishwasher every Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 12, a cook. I've gone through my history. I've done all my life. I saved my money. And I spent a year at Adelphi University in Long Island. I actually became a Dean's List student, went to NYU, transferred there for a year, then went to a school in Rhode Island for a period of time. And the reason I didn't finish college is I didn't have the money. That's the simple answer. And I was not going to ask my parents. And it was unconscionable to me to think that the government would pay for it.
Your next step took you all the way to Santa Barbara, didn't it?
Well, yeah. And it was interesting because I was a house painter. And then I learned how to hang wallpaper. And then I became a contractor and fell off a roof nearly 2.5 stories and busted up all my teeth. I was the only one playing hockey growing up that never lost any teeth, but I lost them that day. And I dislocated my arm, broke my radial head. I had no health insurance. The guy wanted to operate. I said, nope. And I got a guy in a shipyard to give me a job with a busted arm. He didn't know it was busted. He sees me 3 days later. What's wrong with your arm? I tell him, I said, I need the money. And he literally saved my life because I had $200 in the bank at the time. And that's where I started. And that defines me. My passion is real. I got an education. I'm reading the equivalent of a textbook a day in terms of news, information, et cetera. I'm interviewing the best and the brightest in the country every day. That's an education. I've had you as a mentor. That has been a profound education. I actually went back not that long ago, and I had to find VHS tapes online of Renewing American Civilization because I want to go back and watch them. And I had to get an old VHS player to play them. And have somebody set it up for me because it wouldn't play. So to me, I actually take a little bit of pride when people say he dropped out of college. That's meaningless to me. I judge somebody as a person and my religious background. I was an incorrigible child and every one of my teachers would tell you that. And probably the last person they ever thought would ever have any success in life. But their message got through. I do have a conscience, I do have a soul, and I do have a belief in God that is stronger than it's ever been. And I do believe in this country, and I do believe that we have an obligation to protect the great inheritance that was given us. My father died 6 months after I started at Fox. I started in October of 96. He died in March of 97. And, you know, I'd been gone 16 years, 5 years Rhode Island, 5 years California, 2 years Alabama, 4 years Georgia. I didn't get home very often either. I regret it. And, you know, he waited tables on weekends. He was a family court probation guy, my mom a prison guard. And I remember my dad, I got him a satellite dish so he could watch Hannity and Combs at the time. One day he goes to me, where did this all come from? And I said, Dad, you used to yell at me to turn down the radio every night because I wasn't watching TV. I was listening to talk radio, the real pioneers that started talk radio. I stand on their shoulders. My father had a horrible life, grew up poor, depression. His mom died weeks after he was born from complications of childbirth. He went from family member to family member because his father literally came from Ireland, had no money, was working night and day for little to no money, really, really poor. And then he goes fight some World War II. And I stand on the shoulders of those grandparents and parents. You know, I say this to my kids and their eyes roll over. But one day I know, like me, I didn't appreciate them then, but I appreciate them now. And I think my kids will look back and they'll say, yeah, maybe Dad wasn't so dumb after all. But our hope is to save the country for them and our grandkids. You have wonderful grandkids. And you have dedicated your life to all things freedom, liberty, and American greatness and exceptionalism. We have an obligation, I think, to fight with all our heart, mind, body, and soul to make the media mob choke on the words that I mentioned earlier, that we can now project that he's been reelected. And I hope that happens. I think it can happen as well. I like to look at it, though, you got to act like you're 6 points down. You have no timeouts. You're on your own 20. You got to march down the field 80 yards, cross the plane, and kick the extra point to win. If everyone has that sense of urgency, then America will live free for the next generation. And then they'll have to fight for it as well.
I think that's exactly right. Listen, I want to thank you. I want to remind everybody who is listening to our podcast together that they should get Live Free or Die. It's a very important book that really helps explain what's at stake in this year's election. Once again, Sean has done a tremendous contribution to America, not just to conservatism, but to all of America. And I think Live Free or Die is a book which is going to be around a long time, and which historians are someday going to refer to as part of how Donald Trump ruined the night for the media and won re-election once again.
Mr. Speaker, you've transformed my life. Thank you. You're a patriot. You're a great American. You've been a mentor, a friend, and I consider you family, and we need your voice more than ever. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you to my guest and my good friend, Sean Hannity. You can read more about his new book, Live Free or Die, America and the World on the Brink, on our show page at NewsWorld.com. Newt's World is produced by Gamers360 and iHeartMedia. Our executive producer is Debbie Myers, and our producer is Garnes Eastler. The artwork for the show was created by Steve Pendley. Special thanks to the team at Gingrich360. Please email me with your questions at gingrich360.com/questions. I'll answer them in future episodes. If you've been enjoying Newt's World, I hope you'll go to Apple Podcasts and both rate us with 5 stars and give us a review so others can learn what it's all about. On the next episode of Newt's World, the National Institutes of Health and Moderna have announced they are moving to phase 3 clinical trials for COVID-19 vaccine. We'll look at the science behind developing the vaccine, a timeline for its release, and what the vaccine could mean to help contain the virus and restore life as we once knew it. I'm Newt Gingrich. This is Newt's World.